This is Audible.
Simon & Schuster Audio presents Tales from the Shadowhunter Academy, Angels Twice Descending by Cassandra Clare and Robin Wasserman, read by Brett Dalton.
"I think we should have a funeral," George Lovelace said, voice trembling on the last word. "A proper one." Simon Lewis paused in his labors and peered up at his roommate. George was the kind of guy Simon had once loathed on sight, assuming anyone with that bronze glow, those six-pack abs, that maddeningly sexy, at least according to every girl and more than a few of the guys Simon had checked with, Scottish brogue, must have a brain the size of a rat turd and a personality about as appealing. But George turned Simon's assumptions on their head on a daily basis, as he was doing right at this moment, wiping away something that looked suspiciously like a tear. "Are you crying?" Simon asked, incredulous. "Of course not." George gave his eyes another furious wipe. "Well, in my defense," he added, sounding only slightly abashed, "death is a terrible thing." "It's a dead rat," Simon pointed out. "A dead rat in your shoe, I might add." Simon and George had discovered that the key to a happy roommate relationship was clear division of labor. So, George was in charge of disposing of all creatures, rats, lizards, cockroaches, the occasional odd-shaped mishmash of the three whose ancestor had presumably once insulted a warlock, found in the closets or beneath the beds. Simon handled all those that had crawled inside items of clothing, and he shuddered to remember the moment they realized this labor needed assigning, under pillows. "Also, for the record, only one of us has actually been a rat, and you'll note he's not the one crying." "It could be the last dead rat we ever find," George sniffled. "Think about it, Si. This could be the last shared dead rat of our entire lives." Simon sighed. As Ascension Day approached, the day they would officially stop being students and start being shadow hunters, George had been mournfully noting every last time they did anything. Now, as the moon rose over their last night at the academy, he'd apparently lost his mind. A little nostalgia made sense to Simon. That morning, at their last ever calisthenics session, Delaney Scarsbury had called him a spaghetti-armed, four-eyed, bow-legged demon snack in waiting for the last time, and Simon had almost said thank you. And that night's final bowl of meat-flavored custard had admittedly gotten them all a little choked up. But losing it over a rat with stiffening limbs and athlete's foot? That was taking things too far. Using the torn-off cover from his old demonology textbook, Simon managed to scoop the rat out of the shoe without touching it. He dropped it into one of the plastic bags he'd had Isabel bring him specifically for this purpose, tied the bag tightly, then, humming taps, dropped it into the trash. "R.I.P. John Cartwright the 34th, George said solemnly. They named all their rats John Cartwright, a fact that drove the original John Cartwright nuts. Simon smiled at the thought of it, their gallingly cocky classmate's forehead flush with anger, that vein in his disgustingly muscled neck starting to throb. Maybe George was right. Maybe, someday, they would even miss the rats. Simon had never put much effort into imagining his graduation day, much less the night before. Like prom and homecoming, these seemed like rituals meant for a very different kind of teenager. The school-spirited, letter-jacketed jocks and cheerleaders he knew mostly from bad movies. No keg parties for him, no weepy farewells or ill-advised hookups fueled by nostalgia and cheap beer. 2 years ago, if he'd bothered to think about it at all, Simon would have assumed he'd spend that night like he spent most of his nights in Brooklyn, hanging with Eric and the guys and Java Jones, guzzling coffee and brainstorming names for the band. Dead sneaker rat, Simon mused out of habit. Or maybe rodent funeral. Of course, that was back when he'd assumed high school would lead to college, which would lead to rock stardom. Or at least a moderately cool job at a moderately cool record label. Before he knew there was such a thing as demons, before he knew there was a race of super-powered, angel-blooded warriors eternally pledged to battle them, and definitely before he'd volunteered himself up to be one of them. So instead of Java Jones, he was in the Academy's student lounge, squinting through candlelight, sneezing from 2 centuries worth of dust, and dodging the intimidating glares of noble shadow hunters past whose portraits lined the room, their expressions seeming to say, "How could you possibly imagine you could be one of us?" Instead of Eric, Matt, and Kirk, who he'd known since kindergarten, he was with friends he'd met only a couple of years before, one of whom nurtured an intense affection for rats, and another who shared his name with them. Instead of speculating about their futures in rock and roll, they were readying themselves for a life battling multidimensional evils. Assuming, that is, they survived graduation. Which wasn't exactly a safe assumption to make. "What do you think it'll be like?" Marisol Garza asked now, nestled beneath John Cartwright's beefy arm and looking like she was almost happy to be there. "The ceremony, I mean. What do you think we'll have to do?" John, like Julie Beauvale and Beatrice Mendoza, descended from a long line of shadow hunters. For them, tomorrow was just another day. His official farewell to student life. Time to stop training and start battling. But for George, Marisol, Simon, Sunil Sadashivan, and a handful of other mundane students, tomorrow loomed as the day they ascended. No one was quite sure what it meant. Ascension. Much less what it entailed. They'd been told very little. That they would drink from the mortal cup. That they would, like the first of the warrior race, Jonathan Shadowhunter, sip the blood of an angel, that they would, if they were lucky, be transformed on the spot into real, full-blooded shadow hunters, that they would say goodbye to their mundane lives forever and pledge themselves to a fearless life of service to humanity. Or if they were very unlucky, they would die an immediate and presumably gruesome death. Didn't exactly make for a festive evening. "I'm just wondering what's in the cup," Simon said. "You don't think it's actual blood, do you?"
"Isn't that your specialty, Lewis?"
John sneered. George sighed wistfully.
"The last time John makes a stupid vampire joke."
"I wouldn't count on it," Simon muttered. Marisol whacked John's shoulder.
"Shut up, idiot," she said.
But she said it rather too lovingly for Simon's taste. "I bet it's water," Beatrice said, always the peacemaker. "Water that you're supposed to pretend is blood. Or that the cup turns into blood. Or something like that." "It doesn't matter what's in the cup," Julie said in her best obnoxiously knowing way, even though she clearly didn't know any better than the rest of them. "The cup's magic. You could probably drink ketchup out of it and it would still work."
"I hope it's coffee then," Simon said with a wistful sigh of his own.
The Academy was a caffeine-free zone. I'd be a much better shadow hunter if I got to ascend well-caffeinated.
"Sunil said he heard that it's water from Lake Lynn," Beatrice said skeptically.
Simon hoped she was right to be skeptical. His last encounter with Lake Lynn's water had been unsettling, to say the least. And given that some unknown percentage of mundanes died upon ascending, it seemed to him like the cup didn't need any additional help on the occasionally fatal front. "Where is Sunil, anyway?" Simon asked. They hadn't exactly made a plan to meet up tonight, but the Academy offered limited recreational options. At least if you didn't enjoy spending your free time accidentally getting locked in the dungeons, or stalking the giant magical slug rumored to slither through the corridors in the pre-dawn hours. Most nights for the last couple of months, Simon and his friends had ended up here, talking about their futures, and he'd expected they would spend this last night the same way. Marisol, who knew Sunil the best, shrugged. "Maybe he's considering his options." She curled her fingers around the phrase. This was how Dean Penhallow had advised students on the mundane track to spend their final evening, assuring them that there was no shame in backing out at the last moment.
"Humiliation. Lifelong embarrassment over your mundane cowardice and guilt for wasting all of our very valuable time," Scarsbury had growled at them,
and then when the dean shot him a disapproving look. But yeah, sure, no shame.
Well, shouldn't he be considering? Julie asked. Shouldn't you all be? It's not like going to doctor school and taking the hypocritical oath or something. You don't get to change your mind.
First of all, it's the Hippocratic Oath, Marisol said. And it's called medical school? John put in, looking rather proud of himself. Marisol had been schooling him on mundane life, against his will, or so John had led them to believe. Second of all, Marisol added, why would you think any of us would be likely to change our minds? Are you planning to change your mind about being a shadow hunter? Julie looked affronted by the idea.
I am a shadow hunter. You might as well have asked if I'm planning to change my mind about being alive.
So what makes you think it's any different for us? Marisol said fiercely. She was the youngest of them by 2 years and the smallest by several inches, but Simon sometimes thought that she was the bravest. She was certainly the one he'd bet on in a fight. Marisol fought well. She also, when necessary, fought dirty.
She didn't mean anything by it, Beatrice said gently.
I really didn't, Julie said quickly. Simon knew it was true. Julie couldn't help sounding like a mundane hating snob sometimes, any more than John could help sounding like, well, like an asshole sometimes. That's who they were. And Simon realized that, inexplicably, he wouldn't have it any other way. For better or worse, these were his friends. In 2 years, they'd faced so much together. Demons, fairies, Delaney Scarsbury, the dining hall, food. It was almost like a family, Simon reflected. You didn't necessarily like them all the time, but you knew, push come to shove, you'd defend them to the death. Though he very much hoped it wouldn't come to that.
Come on, aren't you a little nervous? John asked. Who can remember the last time anyone ascended? Sounds utterly ridiculous when you think about it. One drink from a cup and poof, Lewis is a shadow hunter?
Doesn't sound ridiculous to me, Julie said softly. And they all fell silent.
Julie's mother had been turned during the Dark War. One drink from Sebastian's infernal cup and she'd become endarkened. A shell of a person. Nothing more than a hollow vessel for Sebastian's evil commands. They all knew what one drink from a cup could do. George cleared his throat. He couldn't stand a somber mood for more than 30 seconds. It was one of the things Simon would miss most about living with him.
Well, I, for one, am entirely ready to claim my birthright, he said cheerfully. Do you think I'll become unbearably arrogant on first sip, or will it take a little time to catch up with John? It's not arrogance if it's accurate, John said, grinning. And just like that, the night righted itself again.
Simon tried to pay attention to his friend's banter, and did his best not to think about John's question, about whether or not he was nervous, and that he should be spending this night in sober consideration of his options.
What options? How, after 2 years at the academy, after all his training and study, after he'd sworn over and over again that he wanted to be a shadow hunter, could he just walk away? How could he disappoint Clary and Isabel like that? And if he did, how could they ever love him again? He tried not to think about how it would be even harder for them to love him, at least for him to appreciate it, if something went wrong in the ceremony, and he ended up dead. He tried not to think about all the other people who loved him, the ones who, according to Shadowhunter law, he was supposed to pledge never to see again. His mother. His sister. Marisol and Sunil didn't have anyone waiting for them back home. Something that had always seemed unbearably sad to Simon. But maybe it was easier, walking away when you were leaving nothing behind. And then there was George, the lucky one. His adopted parents were shadow hunters themselves, even if they'd never picked up a sword. He would still be able to go home for regular Sunday dinners. He wouldn't even have to pick a new name. George had been teasing him lately, saying that Simon shouldn't have much trouble picking a new name either.
Lightwood has quite a ring to it, don't you think? He liked to say.
Simon was getting very good at feigning deafness. Secretly, though, a blush rising to his cheeks, he would think, Lightwood. Maybe. Someday, if he dared let himself hope. In the meantime, though, he had to come up with a new name of his own, a name for his new Shadow Hunter self, which was approximately as unfathomable as everything else about this process.
Can I come in?
A scrawny, spectacled girl of around 13 stood in the doorway. Simon thought her name was Mila, but he wasn't sure. The Academy's new class was so large and so inclined to goggle at Simon from a distance that he hadn't gotten to know many of them. This one had the eager but confused look of a mundane, one who, even after all these months, couldn't quite believe she was really here. It's public property, Julie said, a haughty, or rather even haughtier than usual, note entering her voice. Julie loved lording it over the new kids. The girl crept toward them skittishly. Simon found himself wondering how someone like her had ended up at the Academy, then caught himself. He knew better than to judge by appearances, especially given how he'd looked when he showed up 2 years before, so skinny he could only fit into girl-sized gear. You're thinking like a shadow hunter, he chided himself. Funny how that almost never sounded like a good thing.
He told me to give this to you,
the girl whispered, handing a folded paper to Marisol, then quickly backing away. Marisol, Simon gathered, was somewhat of a hero to the younger mundanes. Who did? Marisol asked, but the girl was already gone. Marisol shrugged and opened the note, her face falling as she read the message. What? Simon asked, concerned. Marisol shook her head. John took her hand and Simon expected her to slap him, but instead she squeezed tight.
It's from Sunil, she said in a tight, angry voice.
She passed the note to Simon.
I guess he considered his options. I can't do it, the note read. I know it probably makes me a coward, but I can't drink from that cup. I don't want to die. I'm sorry. Say goodbye to everyone for me. And good luck.
They passed the note around one by one, as if needing to see the words in black and white before they could really believe it. Sunil had run away.
We can't blame him, Beatrice said finally. Everyone has to make his own choice.
I can blame him, Marisol said, scowling. He's making us all look bad. Simon didn't think that was why she was really angry. Not exactly. He was angry, too. Not because he thought Sunil was a coward or had betrayed them. Simon was angry because he'd put so much effort into trying not to think about what could happen, or how this was his last chance to walk away. And now Sunil had made that impossible. Simon stood up.
Think I need to get some air.
Want some company, mate? George asked.
Simon shook his head, knowing George wouldn't be offended. It was another thing that made them such good roommates. Each knew when to leave the other alone.
See you guys in the morning, Simon said.
Julie and Beatrice smiled and waved goodnight, and even John gave him a sardonic salute. But Marisol wouldn't even look at him, and Simon wondered whether she thought he'd be the next to run. He wanted to reassure her there was no chance of that. He wanted to swear that in the morning he'd be there beside the rest of them in the council hall, ready to take the cup to his lips without reservation. But swearing was a serious thing for shadow hunters. You never promised unless you were absolutely sure. So Simon just said a final goodnight and left his friends behind. Simon wondered whether, in the history of time, anyone had ever said, I need to get some air, and actually meant it. Surely it was only ever used as code for, I need to be somewhere else, which Simon did. The problem was, nowhere felt like the right place to be. So, for lack of a better idea, he decided his dorm room would have to do. At least there he could be alone. This, at least, was the plan. But when he stepped into the room, he found a girl sitting on his bed, a petite, red-headed girl whose face lit up at the sight of him. Of all the strange things that had happened to Simon in the last couple of years,
The strangest had to be that this, beautiful girls eagerly awaiting him in his bedroom, no longer seemed particularly strange at all.
Clary,
he said as he encompassed her in a fierce hug. It was all he needed to say.
Because that's the thing about a best friend. She knew exactly when he most needed to see her, and how grateful and relieved he was, without his having to say a thing.
Clary grinned at him and slipped her steely back into her pocket. The portal she had created was still shimmering in the decrepit stone wall, by far the brightest thing in the room.
Surprised?
Wanted to get one last look at me before I go all buff and demon flattery? Simon teased. Simon, you do know that ascending isn't going to be like getting bitten by a radioactive spider or something, right? So you're saying I won't be able to leap tall buildings in a single bound? And I don't get my own Batmobile? I want my money back.
Seriously, though, Simon. Seriously, Clary. I know what ascension means.
The words sat heavily between them. And as always, Clary heard what he didn't say. That this was too big to talk about seriously. The joking was, for the moment, the best he could do.
Besides, Lewis, I'd say you're buff enough already.
She poked his biceps, which he couldn't help but notice were very close to bulging.
Any more and you'll have to buy new clothes.
Never, he said indignantly, and smoothed out his t-shirt, which had a baker's dozen holes in the soft cotton, and read, I'm cosplaying as myself, in letters nearly too faded to read.
Did you happen to bring Isabel with you?
He tried to keep the hope out of his voice. Hard to believe that 2 years ago he'd come to the academy in part to escape Clary and Isabel, the way they'd looked at him like they'd loved him more than anyone else in the world, but also like he'd drowned their puppy in a bathtub. They'd loved some other version of him, the one he could no longer remember, and that version had loved them, too. He didn't doubt it. He just couldn't feel it. They'd been strangers to him, terrifyingly beautiful strangers who wanted him to be someone he wasn't. It felt like another life. Simon didn't know if he'd ever get all his memories back, but somehow, despite that, he'd found his way back to Clary and Isabel. He'd found a best friend who felt like his other half, who would someday soon be his parabatai. And he'd found Isabel Lightwood, a miracle in human form, who said, I love you, whenever she saw him, and, incomprehensibly, seemed to mean it.
She wanted to come, Clary said, but she had to go deal with this rogue fairy thing in Chinatown, something about soup dumplings and a guy with a goat head. I didn't ask too many questions, and she smiled knowingly at Simon. I lost you at soup dumplings, didn't I?
Simon's stomach growled loudly enough to answer for him.
Well, maybe we can grab you some on the way, Clary said, or at least a couple of slices of pizza and a latte.
Don't toy with me, Frey.
Simon was very touchy these days on the subject of pizza, or the lack thereof. He suspected that any day now his stomach might resign and protest.
On the way where?
Oh, I forgot to explain. That's why I'm here, Simon.
Clary took his hand.
I've come to take you home.
Simon stood on the sidewalk staring up at his mother's brownstone, his stomach churning. Traveling by way of portal always made him feel a bit like puking up his lower intestine, but this time he didn't think he could blame the interdimensional magic. Not entirely, at least.
Are you sure this is a good idea? He said. It's late.
It's 11 p.m., Simon, Clary said. You know she's still awake. And even if she's not, you know...
I know.
His mother would want to see him. So would his sister, who, according to Clary, was home for the weekend because someone, presumably a well-meaning red-headed someone with his sister's cell number, had told her Simon was stopping in for a visit. He sagged against Clary for a moment, and, small as she was, she bore his weight.
I don't know how to do it, he said. I don't know how to say goodbye to them.
Simon's mother thought he was away at military school. He'd felt guilty lying to her, but he'd known there wasn't any other choice. He knew, all too well, what happened when he risked telling his mother too much truth. But this was something else.
He was forbidden by Shadowhunter law to tell her about his ascension, about his new life. The law also forbade him from contacting her after he became a Shadowhunter. And though there was nothing saying he couldn't be here in Brooklyn to say goodbye to her forever, the law forbade him from explaining why. Said Lex, Duralex. The law is hard, but it is the law. Lex sucks, Simon thought. You want me to go in with you? Clary asked. He did, more than anything. But something told him this was one of those things he needed to do on his own. Simon shook his head. But thanks for bringing me here, for knowing I needed it, for, well, for everything. Simon. Clary looked hesitant, and Clary never looked hesitant. What is it? She sighed. Everything that's happened to you, Simon? Everything? She paused, just long enough for him to think through how much that everything encompassed. Getting turned into a rat, then a vampire. Finding Isabel. Saving the world a handful of times. At least, so he'd been told. Getting locked in a cage and tormented by all manner of supernatural creature. Killing demons. Facing an angel. Losing his memories, and now standing at the threshold of the only home he'd ever known, preparing himself to leave it behind forever. I can't help thinking it's all because of me, Clary said softly. That I'm the reason. And he stopped her before she could get any further, because he couldn't stand for her to think she needed to apologize. You're right, he said. You are the reason. For everything. Simon gave her a gentle kiss on the forehead. That's why I'm saying thank you.
Are you sure you don't want me to heat that up for you?
Simon's mother asked as he shoveled another heaping spoonful of cold ziti into his mouth.
Hmm? What? No, it's fine.
It was more than fine. It was tangy tomato and fresh garlic and hot pepper and gooey cheese and better than leftover pasta from the corner pizza place had any right to be. Tasted like actual food, which already put it head and shoulders above what he'd been eating for the last several months. But it wasn't just that. Takeout from Giuseppe's was a tradition for Simon and his mother. After his father died and his sister went away to school, after it was just the two of them knocking around an apartment that felt cavernous with just the two of them left in it, they'd lost the habit of having daily meals with each other. It was easier to just grab food whenever they thought of it. On the way in or out of the apartment, his mother heating up TV dinners after work, Simon picking up some pho or a sandwich on his way to band practice. It was maybe easier not to face the empty chairs at the table every night. But they made it a rule to eat together at least one night a week, slurping down Giuseppe's spaghetti and drenching garlic knots in spicy sauce. These cold leftovers tasted like home, like family. And Simon hated to think of his mother sitting in the empty apartment, week after week, eating them on her own. Children are supposed to grow up and leave, he told himself. He wasn't doing anything wrong. He wasn't doing anything he wasn't meant to do. But there was a part of him that wondered. Children were supposed to leave home, maybe, but not forever. Not like this.
Your sister tried to wait up for you, his mother said.
But apparently she's been up for a week straight studying for exams. She was passed out on the couch by 9. Maybe we should wake her up, Simon suggested. She shook her head. Let the poor girl sleep. She'll see you in the morning. He hadn't exactly told his mother he was staying over, but he had let her believe it, which he supposed amounted to about the same thing. Yet another lie. She settled into the chair behind him and stabbed a ziti onto her fork.
Don't tell my diet,
she stage whispered, then popped it into her mouth.
Mom, the reason I'm here, I wanted to talk to you about something.
That's funny, I've been waiting to talk to you about something too.
Oh, great, you go first.
His mother sighed.
You remember Ellen Klein, your Hebrew school teacher?
How can I forget? Simon said wryly. Mrs. Klein had been the bane of his existence from 2nd grade through 5th. Every Tuesday after school, they'd fought a silent war, all because, in an unfortunate playground incident, Simon had accidentally dislodged her wig and sent it flying into a pigeon's nest. She'd spent the next 3 years determined to ruin his life. You know she was just a nice old lady trying to get you to pay attention, his mother said now with a knowing smile. Nice old ladies don't throw your Pokemon cards in the trash, Simon pointed out. They do when you're trading them for kiddish wine at the back of the sanctuary, she said. I would never. A mother always knows, Simon. Okay, fine. But that was a very rare Mew, the only Pokemon that... Anyway, Ellen Klein's daughter just got married to her girlfriend, a lovely woman. You'd like her. We all like her, but... Simon rolled his eyes. But let me guess, Mrs. Klein is a raging homophobe? No, it's not that. The girlfriend's Catholic. Ellen had a fit, wouldn't go to the wedding, and now she's wearing mourning clothes and telling everyone that her daughter might as well be dead. Simon opened his mouth to crow about how he'd been right all along, that Mrs. Klein was indeed a horrible shrew, but his mother held up a finger to stop him. A mother, apparently, always knows. Yes, yes, it's horrible, but I am not telling you so you can feel vindicated. I am telling you. She knitted her fingers together, looking suddenly nervous. I had the strangest feeling when I heard the story, Simon. Like, I knew she would regret it, because I regretted it. Isn't that strange? She let out a nervous little giggle, but there was no humor in it. Feeling guilty for something you haven't even done. I can't say why, Simon, but I feel like I've betrayed you in some terrible way I can't remember. Of course you haven't, Mom. That's ridiculous. Of course it's ridiculous. I would never. A parent should have unconditional love for her child. Her eyes were glossy with unshed tears. You know that's how I love you, Simon. Don't you? Unconditionally. Of course I know that. He said it like he meant it. He did mean it. But, of course, it was just another lie. Because in that other life, the one that had been wiped clean from both their minds, she had betrayed him. He'd told her the truth, that he'd been turned into a vampire, and she had thrown him out of the house. She had told him he was no longer her son, that her son was dead. She'd proven to both of them the conditions of her love. He couldn't remember it happening, but on some level deeper than conscious thought, he remembered the feeling of it. The pain, the betrayal, the loss. It had never occurred to him she might remember too. This is silly. She brushed away a tear, gave herself a little shake. I don't know why I'm getting so emotional over this. I just had this feeling that I needed to tell you that. And then you showed up here like it was meant to be, and... Mom. Simon pulled his mother out of her chair and into a tight hug. She seemed so small to him suddenly. He thought how hard she'd worked all these years to protect him, and how he would do anything to protect her in return. He was a different person now than he'd been 2 years before. A different Simon than the one who'd confessed to his mother and been turned out of the house. Maybe his mother was different too. Maybe making that choice once was enough to ensure she would never make it again. Maybe it was time to stop holding it against her. This betrayal neither of them could quite remember. Mom, I know. And I love you too. She pulled away then, just far enough to meet his gaze. What about you? What did you have to tell me?
Oh, nothing much. Just joining a supernatural cult of demon fighters who've forbidden me to ever see you again. Love ya. Didn't quite have the right ring to it.
I'll tell you in the morning, he said. You look exhausted. She smiled. Exhaustion painted across her face. In the morning, she echoed. Welcome home, Simon. Thanks, Mom, he said, and miraculously managed to do so without getting choked up. He waited for her to disappear behind her bedroom door, waited for her soft snores to begin. Then he scribbled a note apologizing for having to leave so abruptly, without saying goodbye. His sister snored too, though, like their mother, she denied it. He could, if he stayed very silent, hear her all the way in the kitchen. He could wake her up, if he wanted, and he could probably even tell her the truth, or some version of it. Rebecca could be trusted, not just to keep his secrets, but to understand them. He could do what he'd come here to do, what he was supposed to do, say goodbye to her and tell her to love and protect their mother enough for both of them. No. He'd spoken softly, but the words seemed to echo in the empty kitchen. The law was hard, but it was also riven with loopholes. Hadn't Clary taught him that? There were shadow hunters who found a way to keep their mundane loved ones in their lives. Simon himself was proof. Maybe that was why Clary had brought him here tonight. Not to say goodbye, but to realize that he couldn't. Wouldn't. This isn't forever, Simon promised his mother and sister as he slipped out the door. He promised himself it wasn't cowardly, leaving without saying anything. It was a silent promise that this wasn't the end, that he'd find a way. And despite the fact that there was no one to appreciate his flawless Schwarzenegger accent, he swore his oath aloud.
I'll be back.
Clary had said to give her a call when he was ready to head back to the academy. But he wasn't ready yet. It was strange. In another day, there'd be nothing keeping him from returning to New York for good. After his ascension, he'd be a shadow hunter for real. No more school, no more training missions, no more long days and nights and Idris missing his morning coffee. He hadn't given much thought to what would happen next, but he knew he'd come home to the city and stay in the Institute, at least temporarily. There was no reason to feel so homesick for New York when he was this close to being back for good. Except he wasn't quite sure who he'd be when he came back. When he ascended. If he ascended. Nothing terrible happened when he took his drink from the mortal cup. What would it mean to become a shadow hunter, really? He'd be stronger and swifter, he knew that much. He'd be able to bear runes on his skin, see through glamours without a warlock's help. He knew plenty about what he'd be able to do, but he didn't know anything about how it would feel. About who he'd be when he was a shadow hunter. It's not that he thought one drink from a magic cup would instantly turn him into an egomaniacal, preternaturally handsome, wildly reckless snob like almost all the shadow hunters he knew and loved. Nor did he expect that turning into a shadow hunter would make him automatically disdain D&D, Star Trek, and all technology and pop culture invented after the 19th century. But who could know for sure? And it wasn't just the confusing transformation from human to angel warrior. He'd been assured that, in all likelihood, if he survived ascension, he would get back all his memories. All those memories of the original Simon, the real Simon, the one he'd worked so hard to persuade people would be gone forever, would come flooding back into his brain. He supposed this should make him happy. But Simon found he felt rather territorial of his brain as it was now. What if that Simon, the Simon who'd saved the world, the Simon whom Isabel had first fallen in love with, didn't much like this Simon that he'd become? What if he drank from the cup and lost himself all over again? It gave him a headache, thinking of himself as so many different people. He wanted one last night in the city as just this one. Simon Lewis. Myopic, manga-loving, mundane. Also, he still wanted some of those soup dumplings. Simon wandered down Flatbush, soaking in the familiar noises of New York at night. Sirens and construction drills and road rage honking, along with the slightly less familiar sounds of glamored fairy hounds barking at the pigeons. He crossed the Manhattan Bridge, metal rattling beneath his feet as the subway roared past, the lights of the financial district glittering through the fog. Even before he'd known anything about demons and downworlders, Simon thought he had always known New York was full of magic. Maybe that was why it had been so easy for him to accept the truth about the shadow world. In his city, anything was possible. Conveniently, the bridge dumped him off in the heart of Chinatown. As he popped into his favorite hole in the wall and scarfed a to-go order of dumplings, Simon's mind strayed to Isabel, wondering if she was close by, slashing evildoers with her electrum whip. It boggled his mind. If you thought about it, he was basically dating a superhero. Of course, the thing about dating a superhero was that you couldn't exactly ask them to take a break from saving the world just because you were in the mood for a last-minute date. So, Simon kept walking, soaking in the rhythm of the midnight city, letting his mind wander as aimlessly as his feet. At least, he thought he was wandering aimlessly, until he found himself on a familiar block of Avenue D, passing a bodega where the milk was always sour, but the guy behind the counter would give you free coffee with your morning donut, if you knew enough to ask. Wait, how did I know that? Simon thought. The answer came to him on the heels of the question. He knew that because, in some other forgotten life, he had lived here. He and Jordan Kyle had shared an apartment in a crumbling red brick building on the corner, a vampire and a werewolf living together. It sounded like the beginning of a bad joke, but the only bad joke was that Simon had practically forgotten it ever happened. And Jordan was dead. It hit him now, almost as hard as it had when he first heard. Jordan was dead. And not just Jordan. Raphael was dead. Isabel's brother Max, dead. Clary's brother Sebastian, dead. Julie's sister, Beatrice's grandfather and father and brother, Julian Blackthorne's father, Emma Carstairs' parents, all of them dead. Those were only the ones Simon had been told about. How many other people he had cared about, or people the people he loved had cared about, had been lost to one shadow hunter war or another. He was still a teenager. He wasn't supposed to know this many people who had died. And me, he thought suddenly. Don't forget that one. Because it was true, wasn't it? Before life as a vampire, there had been death. Cold and bloodless and underground. Then later there'd been the forgetting, and that was a kind of death too. Simon wasn't even a shadow hunter yet, and already this life had taken so much from him. Simon, I thought you'd be here. Simon turned around and was reminded that for all the losses, there had also been some very significant gains. Isabel, he breathed. And then, for quite a while, his lips were too occupied to speak. They went back to Magnus and Alec's apartment. The couple had taken their new baby on vacation to Bali, which meant Simon and Isabel could have the place to themselves. You sure it's okay for us to be here? Simon asked, looking nervously around the apartment. The last time he'd seen it, the decorating ethos had been part Studio 54, part Bordello. Lots of disco balls, velvet curtains, and some appallingly placed mirrors. Now the living room looked like something puked up by a Babies R Us. Blankets and diapers and mobiles and stuffed bunnies everywhere you look. He still couldn't believe Magnus Bane was someone's dad. I'm sure, Isabel said, stripping off her dress in one smooth motion to reveal the unending stretches of smooth, pale skin that lay beneath. But if you want to leave... No, Simon said, struggling for enough breath to speak. Definitely... No, here's good. Very good. Well, then, Isabel swept a family of stuffed kittens off the couch, then stretched across like a very satisfied and very dangerous cat. She looked pointedly at Simon's shirt, which was still on his body. Well, then, Simon stood above her, unsure what to do next. Simon, yes, I'm looking pointedly at your shirt. Uh-huh. Which is still on your body.
Oh, right.
He took care of that, dropping down beside her on the couch. Simon.
Yes? Oh, right.
Simon leaned toward her and pulled her close for a kiss, which she indulged for about 30 seconds before extricating herself. What's wrong? He asked.
You tell me, she said. I, your incredibly sexy girlfriend that you never get to see, am prostrating myself before you half naked, and you seem like you'd rather be watching a baseball game.
I hate baseball.
Exactly.
Isabel sat up, though Mercifully, she didn't put any clothes back on. Not yet. You know you can talk to me about anything, right? Simon nodded. So if, hypothetically, you were feeling a little nervous about this whole ascension thing tomorrow, and wondering whether you still wanted to go through with it, you could talk to me about that.
Hypothetically, Simon said.
Just picking a topic at random, Isabel said. We could also talk about Avatar, the last airplane, if you wanted.
It's the airbender, Simon said, suppressing a grin. And I love you even if you are nerd clueless.
And I love you, even if you are mundane, she said. Even if you stay a mundane. You know that, right?
I